I am Charlie Baker, and I am an alcoholic. View is a lot different from up here than it is from sitting back there. When Bill called and said the committee had asked me to speak up here this morning, I got a little concerned about that, because sitting back there, I've gotten so much from all the people that have stood up here and given themselves. And I started talking with my wife about it. And she said, well, if it's like most meetings, she said, about a third of the people are going to love what you have to say, and about a third of the people are going to think you're full of crap, and about a third of the people probably aren't even listening anyway. So that helped me out quite a bit. She's real loving and supportive and nurturing. But it is an honor and a privilege to be asked to share up here, because this workshop has become real special in my life and in my program. I've learned so much about these steps, and from these sessions later on this morning, I started to learn a lot about how to actually apply them in my life. I'm real grateful to be here today and to be sober. I was born in Ohio in 1955, and I didn't have any brothers and sisters, and I always grew up having to live up to other people's expectations. At an early age in kindergarten, I had a kindergarten teacher told my parents that I was definitely college material. And from that day on, it was like I never could quite meet up to whatever everybody expected of me. And those burdens were weighed me down for years and years. And I always tried to be what I thought other people wanted me to be. If I was with a rough crowd, I could be rough. If I was with the cool crowd, I tried to be cool. If I was in the crowd that was trying to go somewhere in life, I could be that way too. It was like I was a chameleon with my feelings and with my emotions and how I reacted to people. I played off of what other people had to offer, and I didn't have those things in myself, because I never was quite sure of who I was. I kind of felt like an accidental tourist going through life as I was growing up. Kind of felt like an observer, just was always looking around at other people, and never quite felt like I fit in or belonged in any of those crowds that I tried to fit in with. That led to a lot of feelings of being real lonely growing up, and I never knew what to do with that, and I kept trying to find it in all the different groups and find what I was looking for in all the different places, and I never could. I was always unsuccessful with that. I grew up being fairly rebellious towards my father. Whatever he wanted me to do was exactly what I did not want to do. As I was going through school, I always made fairly good grades. And always had plans based on that day in kindergarten that I knew that I was going to be successful one of these days in life. And I didn't know where or how or what, but I knew that someday, you know, those things would happen for me. And I continued to live in that kind of a fantasy world that one day, like, my ship would come in. One day everything would be all right. One day I'd have all of those things that I had been looking for all my life. When I got out of high school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. High school is a painful enough experience in itself, too, when you start to dabble with relationships and things like that, and always being afraid of women and always being afraid of getting hurt. But I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I'd always had a few side jobs doing some landscaping work, and I wound up finding a school that offered that in a town nearby and decided to pursue that, especially after my dad decided he wanted me to be a dentist. So I wanted to be just about the opposite thing that I could think of to be, and that was it. That first year of school was real rough. To back up a little bit, in some of my drinking and using careers, some things went back to in the earlier stages that kept telling me that I could control things. The first time that I can actually remember taking a drink was I was about 14 years old, and a group of us went and camped out overnight. got somebody to buy some beer. And when I started drinking that night, it was, you know, all of those insecurities and doubts and fears that I had kind of slipped away, and I could be loud and boisterous and one of the crowd and carry on with everybody else and not worry about what anybody was thinking about me. Drinking had always been a big part in my family. Even though I didn't have any brothers and sisters, I was from a real large family, and family get-togethers always had drinking going on. And it was a way of life. I thought that's what you did, is that you worked hard and you came home and you drank hard. I found out fairly quickly after that first night, the insanity of that next morning, even with the hangover. And I can remember dragging a sleeping bag over my shoulder on the way home and just hung over. And it was hot that morning, and I was sweaty and sick because that night when I drank, I got drunk and I had a blackout and I had a hangover the next morning. And I was thinking, boy, I don't ever want to have to go through this again. And about 15 minutes later, it was trying to figure out how we could do it again the next night. I do have to mention drugs in my talk some, because that's a part of my disease. It's part of what helped get me to this program today. And when my first experience with drugs, and my mother discovered some stuff, and she decided that she wanted to take me to go talk to our family doctor. And I said, sure, I'll go talk to him. So I made sure that I was in the right frame of mind to go and listen to whatever this man would have to say, because I sure was sure that it wasn't going to be very favorable. And we went and talked with him that evening, and he told her that what I did was really none of her business. And he told me that whatever I did, I didn't really need to tell her. And that got my attention, because, you know, he was telling me it was validating that what I was doing was okay, that I was still in charge of things. I was in control. I could handle things. Based on what I was going through at school at the time, I knew that one of these days I was going to have a successful career and a nice home and a family and make big money, and you know, I was going to be happy. And so I didn't ever really worry too much about what I was doing today, because I knew one of these days that it was all going to be all right. That was pretty much a pattern that set in, and that was the way that I lived for the next several years. My first year in school was real rough. I started partying a lot. The thing about drinking that I found out was that I didn't like to drink during the day. Didn't even really like to drink during the week, because the one thing I found out with drinking is when I started drinking, I didn't like to stop. I couldn't stop drinking until we either ran out of something to drink or ran out of money or I passed out. It was one of the three. So I kept trying to kind of keep the drinking on the back burner, but I couldn't cope with all of those insecurities and the way that I felt inside. So I had to find something, and drugs were a big part of that during the day. And during the week, and on the weekends, it was a big blowout with the drinking. The first year of school in college, I worked part-time and drove an hour to and from school, and it was real rough. So the second year of school, I was able to, it was like playing Monopoly. I had a life insurance policy matured, and I was able to collect a sum of money and move up there so I could study more. And I did the logical thing with that. I took and I spent all of that money on drugs, and that was how I financed my way through school my second year. Again, the drinking kept creeping more and more and more into things. And that second year of school, I made Dean's List. And I studied a lot, and I worked real hard, and I consumed more and more drugs and more alcohol. But you know, when I made that Dean's List, I was still in control. I could still handle it. It was still okay for me to keep doing those things. Because I knew that, you know, it was all right, because one of these days everything was going to be all right. You know, one of these days I would be all right. So I got out of college and had a cousin of mine that was up for Thanksgiving. He came over and said, why don't you come back down to Atlanta with me? And we'd been drinking all day long, so like a good alcoholic, I thought long and hard for about 30 seconds and said, sure. And I borrowed a little bit of money from my folks and came down to Atlanta the next day. And I can look back today and I can see that was, as much as anything, was a geographical cure, because at that point I kind of knew that the drinking and the drugs, but the drinking was starting to cause a problem. And that if I moved away from all those people I did all that stuff with, then I'd probably be able to start over fresh. You know, and things would be different down here. And I could get on pursuing that career and the fame and fortune and all those good things that was going to make me feel okay one of these days. And it took about a week and a half to 2 weeks to start to find the same people in Atlanta that I'd moved away from Ohio to get away from, and to start to find all of the things down here that I moved away from up there. And I found something down here that my cousin took me to that was just fascinating to me, and it was called Happy Hour. And you could buy one drink and they would bring you three drinks, you know. And I just thought that I had done died and gone to heaven. And I got out and I found a job and was the youngest foreman that this particular county had ever hired, and it was obvious validation that here again I was on my way to fame and fortune. And I started to try to assume what the kind of lifestyle that I thought went along with that. And that was, I tried to stay as happy at those happy hours as I could for as long as I could. And it was an every night thing. The drinking started getting worse and worse. Drinking finally started causing me some problems with jobs. I actually wound up getting fired from a job. That was something that, it took me probably a year and a half of being sober to look back and realize that they fired me because I should have been fired. That because for a long time I thought they fired me because of all these other reasons that they had, and I didn't really deserve to be fired, but they was kind of in a position that they had to let me go to save face, and I could be okay with that. I couldn't own up to the fact that I deserved to be fired. Actually, I thought at that time I was starting to have some medical problems, because the thing was, what they fired me for was because I couldn't get to work on time. I had a serious problem with getting up in the morning and with my physical condition when I got up, because I'd be real sick and real shaky. And I knew deep down inside that there was something wrong. You know, I didn't know if they had a name for that disease yet or not. And I sure didn't have any idea what the disease was that I had at that time. There's a few relationships thrown in there. As a matter of fact, the one that kicked that incident off with getting fired was I had discovered bourbon, you know, and it was like beer and wine was nice, but liquor was quicker. And it was to help ease the pain of getting out of a sick relationship that I had gotten into, that was just like all the other relationships that I had been into all my life with women. And it was because I didn't feel okay about myself. I knew one of these days I would, when my ship came in or I got to the dock or whichever. But you know, all those relationships were all based on making me feel better about myself, because I couldn't do that on my own. I was always trying to look in other places to find that, to be okay with me. The next few years of my life were just pretty much a blur. That pattern continued to get worse as far as the drinking on a daily basis, and the drugs got worse and worse. It's kind of like when you're a little kid and you draw a line in the sand and say, I dare you to cross that line. Well, for a long time I had some lines there that I didn't cross, and as time went on and as my disease progressed, I started crossing those lines, and I had to draw new ones rapidly. I started to get a feeling that life was passing me by, and I started to get filled with a lot of fear and a lot of resentments, that looking around and seeing those things that at an earlier age, you know, I knew was going to be mine. You know, other people were getting, and I was afraid they were getting my share. And those things were slipping away from me, and I didn't know what to do about it. So I did the only thing that I knew to do at that time, and that was that I got deeper and deeper into the bottle. Started to have some problems with the DUIs. Started to have some problems with everything in my life. That's what it comes down to, is just simply I started to have a problem with everything, a problem with relationships, with a career, with the police, with living. I didn't even know how to live anymore. I isolated a lot. I found that I could drink a lot more. I could make my dollar go farther by stretching it out at home and sitting there in the evenings and sit down with a 12-pack and not even move. I started to think that I might be a catatonic schizophrenic because I'd studied psychology. And, you know, I knew they just kind of sat there, and that was me. I could just come home and sit there and not move. You know, I watched stuff on TV that I didn't like. You know, the only time I'd change a channel is when I'd have to get up to go to the bathroom. But things continued to get worse, and it was like there was about a 10-year blur there where it was just the same. It was just the routine of getting up and feeling bad and feeling guilty about yesterday and being afraid of tomorrow and trying to figure out how I was going to get out of this next whatever that was in front of me, whether it was a court date or it was a DUI or, you know, the frustrations of the career business had progressed to where I would start with a company and I'd bust my butt for a month and a couple of weeks later, when they didn't take advantage and recognize my abilities and promote me to at least a vice president, I would get discouraged and disgusted and fed up and leave shortly thereafter. And in 1984, I have nothing against country and western music. I like country and western music. I like all kinds of music, but by that time I had started to really get into those country and western songs, the hurt and the pain and She Done Me Wrong it was really beneficial to my drinking, you know. My life started to become like some of those country songs that I heard. My dog died, I wrecked my pickup truck. 3 days later, a tornado came through and blew a tree down on top of the truck. And things started really falling apart at a pretty fast clip, and I didn't know what to do about it, and I knew things were out of control. Kind of got through it one more time, and in June of 1984, in a blackout, I ran into a lady head on the wrong side of the road. And when I came to, I couldn't understand why everybody was over here paying attention to her and why they weren't over here and taking care of me, because I reached up and I felt blood. And today I understand it's the disgust that people have about what the problems and the havoc and the devastation that alcoholics cause in other people's lives. They took us to the hospital, and the lady was okay, thank God, but I had about 18 stitches in my face, that night I was too ashamed to call anybody to come and get me out, you know, to come and take me home. And I walked home from the hospital, and at the age of 30, I decided the only honorable thing left to do in life was to run away. You know, because I was supposed to go to court the next day for a DUI that I got 2 months before, and I got one the night before. So the next morning, I got up and I said that famous, everything was fine for about 15 seconds, and then the thoughts of everything from the night before, and it was like all of a sudden just everything that had happened in the last 10, 15 years of my life hit me at once. And I said that those famous three or four words that I think a lot of us have said, and that was, God, please help me. Because when I looked in the mirror, I was scared to death. You know, I was filled with terror of not knowing what was going to happen. Because, see, I was one of those kind of quiet garden variety drunks. There wasn't a lot of tragedy in my life. There wasn't a lot of things on the outside. But I had gone as far as I could go with those feelings on the inside. I just could not stand how I felt any longer. And I had to do something about it. I didn't know what that was. I got on the phone and started making some calls. And there was an angel of mercy that calmed me down and directed me to a hospital up in Buford, Georgia. And I had my backpack packed because I still wasn't sure if I was going to Texas. For some reason, Texas appealed to me. I thought if I was going to run away, that was going to be a good place to go. So I started trying to hitchhike a ride up there, and it was about 25 miles away from where I lived. And at that time, I weighed 118 pounds, and I had about 18 stitches in my face, and nobody would pick me up. And I started walking. And I walked, and it would be real dramatic to stand here and tell you I walked all the way to treatment, but I didn't. I got tired. I called a taxi. But when I walked in the doors of that treatment center, something happened. They talked to me and asked me if I wanted to stay, and I said yes, and I took my backpack off and set it down, and I sat down in a chair in the hallway, and with people walking by, I just started bawling like a baby. I knew something had to happen, and there was something, a feeling that came over me when I got there that maybe there was something that could help me here. And something did happen. Miracles began to happen in my life. I mean, immediately. From that moment that I said that prayer, God did start to help me in my life. And I knew later on, in looking back, I knew that he had been helping me all along just to keep me alive long enough to get me to that point of being able to get that one moment of clarity that helps me decide, make that choice that I wanted to get some help. The next 28 days were full of discovery, and it was wonderful. And I needed that time to get away from things and to get away from people. And I moved I started to change my playgrounds and playmates, and the most important thing that they did when I was in treatment was they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I seen people with smiles on their faces and people that were enjoying life and that were happy, and that's what I wanted, because I kept waiting on all those things to happen out there, and they never happened. And I didn't start to find those things until I got here with you people. Started talking about working these steps, and I worked 1, 2, and 3 real hard for a good 2, 2.5 years. And I stayed right there. I couldn't go any farther, because I was more or less voted most likely to stay sober when I was in treatment. And so I figured that some of the suggestions they give you didn't really apply, so I immediately jumped on into the relationships. And I bypassed waiting on that first year business and jumped right in there. And the thing was, is I found out that I had about as much success with relationships sober as I did drunk. Because I still had all of the same tools. And it wasn't until I reached an emotional bottom with relationships. I stayed in the sickest relationship I'd ever had in my life after I got sober. And it wasn't until I got into working on the steps and working on me did I ever start to make any progress with relationships. And I started to look at how relationships in my life had affected me, how they had affected my ego and my pride, and how I used other people to make me feel okay about me. And in working through these steps and the freedom and that came from the steps, where I could start to reclaim that responsibility for how I felt and take it back from other people. I started to improve in relationships, and I started to improve in relationships with women and on the jobs and with my family members and relationships in all areas of my life. And that's how the steps have been working in my life, is it's an inside-out job. I've heard a lot of people talk, and I know that I've had those same thoughts of, I need to work on relationships, I need to work on this, and I need to work on that. And what I found out, at least what was my experience, was that I had to work on me, and I had to use these steps. And that was the only way that I ever got any better at these other areas. Miracles have happened in my life. A year ago in April, I was at this workshop, and two weeks after that, I got married to a wonderful girl that's one of the gifts that this program has given me. And we have a very happy and a very healthy relationship. And we worked damn hard at it, and I'm real proud of it. I love her dearly. That dad that I had fought and been so rebellious with for so many years, 3 weeks after we got married, I also could fit in with Anglers Anonymous because I am a fishing addict. Me and my wife went down to Lake Oconee down here fishing. And that Sunday morning, we had listened to one of Noel's tapes. I had just gotten Noel's tape from that workshop. And we cried, and I came back here to this workshop. And, you know, and I was filled with a spirit that I always get when I'm here. And we had a wonderful day that day. And that day when I went home, I found my dad had died. One of the gifts that this program has given me and one of the miracles that have come from the magic and the power of these steps is the 2 weeks before that the 3 weeks before that when I had gotten married, the day of my marriage, me and my father, things worked out that we were standing there by ourselves just before I was to go on. And I was able to grab that man and tell him how much that I loved him and how much that he had meant to me in my life. You know, and I wouldn't have had that if it hadn't been for these steps. You know, because I couldn't do those things. I hated that man, and I never wanted to be like him. And when I started to work these steps, I seen how I was the spitting image of him. You know? And because of these steps, I was able to start to grow and love him for who he was and how he is and accept him exactly as he is. And I've been able to start to apply those things in all areas of my life. Sometimes I don't do real good at them, but I do a lot better at them than I used to. And today I'm feeling like I'm starting to have some of those things that the people offered that to me when I got here, and that's those things that I wanted, that freedom and that being happy. You know, I always knew that by the time I turned 30 years old that I was going to have it together. You know, little did I know I was going to be hitting rock bottom, but you know, I found that I did find it. I did get it all together because I found you people and I found God through these steps. Because the source of the power to be able to work on these steps for me is spiritual growth. I can't do it on my own. And I have to have that power greater than me that can help restore me. And that power is what helps me to work through these steps. But I am real grateful to have had the opportunity to be here and to share with you this morning. Get a sponsor. I'm working. And as I say that, I have to stand here and in all honesty admit that that's something that's been a little slack for me. And I've just found it, asked a man to be my sponsor recently that I thank the world of, and we're starting to go through those steps again in my life because I never get through with them. They're always there, and there's always more for me to learn. That has helped me a great deal. I am real grateful to be here today, and I was real hesitant about coming up here because from all the people that I've seen up here in the past, it was a real humbling experience to think about it. But you know, I didn't come here to entertain. All I have to share is my experience, strength, and hope. You know, just as what you people have given me for these years, and I'm real grateful for that. Coming to these meetings is kind of like, I heard, it's kind of like being, you know, going to after you've left an orgy. You know, when you walk out the door, you feel real good, and you're just never quite sure who did it to you. That's what this program has been like for me. That's especially what these weekends are like for me. And I'm real grateful to have had the opportunity to share it with y'all. And thank you very much. That dad that I had fought and been so rebellious with for so many years. 3 weeks after we got married, I also could fit in with Anglers Anonymous because I am a fishing addict. Me and my wife went down to Lake Oconee down here fishing. And that Sunday morning, we had listened to one of Noel's tapes. I had just gotten Noel's tape from that workshop, and we cried, and I came back here to this workshop, and I was filled with the spirit that I always get when I'm here. And we had a wonderful day that day, and that day when I went home, I found my dad had died. And one of the gifts that this program has given me, and one of the miracles that have come from the magic and the power of these steps, is the 2 weeks before that, the 3 weeks before that, when I had gotten married, the day of my marriage, me and my father, things worked out that we were standing there by ourselves just before I was to go on, and I was able to grab that man and tell him how much that I loved him and how much that he had meant to me in my life. You know, and I wouldn't have had that if it hadn't been for these steps. You know, because I couldn't do those things. I hated that man, and I never wanted to be like him. And when I started to work these steps, I seen how I was the spitting image of him. You know? And because of these steps, I was able to start to grow and love him for who he was and how he is, and accept him exactly as he is. And I've been able to start to apply those things in all areas of my life. And sometimes I don't do real good at them, but I do a lot better at them than I used to. And today I'm feeling like I'm starting to have some of those things that the people offered that to me when I got here, and that's those things that I wanted, that freedom and that being happy. I always knew that by the time I turned 30 years old that I was going to have it together. You know, little did I know I was going to be hitting rock bottom, but I found that I did find it. I did get it all together because I found you people and I found God through these steps. Because the source of the power to be able to work on these steps for me is spiritual growth. I can't do it on my own. And I have to have that power greater than me that can help restore me. And that power is what helps me to work through these steps. But I am real grateful to have had the opportunity to be here and to share with you this morning. Get a sponsor. I'm working. And as I say that, I have to stand here and in all honesty admit that that's something that's been a little slack for me. And I've just found it, asked a man to be my sponsor recently that I thank the world of. And we're starting to go through those steps again in my life because I never get through with them. They're always there, and there's always more for me to learn. That has helped me a great deal. I am real grateful to be here today, and I was real hesitant about coming up here because from all the people that I've seen up here in the past, it was a real humbling experience to think about it. But I didn't come here to entertain. All I have to share is my experience, strength, and hope. Just as what you people have given me for these years, and I'm real grateful for that. Coming to these meetings is kind of like, I heard, is kind of like being, going to, after you've left an orgy. When you walk out the door, you feel real good, and you're just never quite sure who did it to you. That's what this program has been like for me. That's especially what these weekends are like for me. And I'm real grateful to have had the opportunity to share it with y'all. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Charlie. If anybody's in this room and they can't get happy over that, we better carry you outside and bury you. I tell you, I'm so happy for you, Charlie, I don't know what to do. Our next speaker, also from kind of in the mountain section up there around Helen, Georgia, kind of always reminds me of a plowboy I used to know years ago. Tom, where are you? Tom Hickey, come on up. I love you, buddy.
Wow, boy. I'm Tom Hickey. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, Tom. Hi, everybody. I'm real grateful to be here today, to be with everybody. I love everybody here. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. This is a real special place to me, and the guy right here on my right, Bill, is real special to me, like a lot of the guys here that were here when I came here for the first time. And I hadn't been in Georgia all that long, and I really didn't know the wider AA community until I came down to this workshop. And I've been real grateful that it's here, and I keep coming back every time, and it really helps me in my sobriety and in my life, and come to know more and more people here and love a lot of people that are here. And like I was telling Tony that I came with yesterday, just driving in here and seeing the same guys that I hear every year, you know, it just gives me a great feeling of the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And really, that's what I want to share with you all this morning, some of my experience and strength and hope around the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which to me is a way of life that's second to none. And to me, it's a way of life that's a miracle. It represents the miracle of the 20th century. And, you know, we know today that Bill Wilson is considered one of the most renowned, famous individuals of this century by a lot of folks. And I feel like, you know, being here with this number of people, that's the feeling I get, you know. And I'm just one person, and I'm just one part of this whole thing that's a worldwide, powerful, growing community of people who are committed to the idea of better health and a spiritual way of life, better health specifically through living a spiritual way of life, which, according to the way I learned it, comes from the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that came out in that book in 1939. And those steps are the way I try to live my life. And if you never heard it this way, maybe you knew, but those steps are basically a set of principles that are spiritual in their nature. And if they are practiced as a way of life, they're guaranteed to do one thing. They're guaranteed to expel the obsession to drink or use any other mind-altering drug. And that's what it's all about. And that's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. It's simple and it's basic. I'm not here to become a spiritual giant or a sweetheart. I think I'll never make it, you know? But I am here to stay sober. And that's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is for. And as I learn and continue to stay sober, I'm able to deal with other problems and conflicts that come up in my personality and in my life as I try to live it today. And that's the miracle and the wonder of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'll tell you, I was the kind of guy on my, you know, left to my own devices. I drank automatically, and I drank every day. And on my own one time, I tried to stay sober, and I lasted for 2.5 days. And that's as long as I was ever able to stay sober on my own. And since coming to this program on the 26th of January, 1969, and sitting around with y'all and listening to what you had to say and hanging out with y'all and reading the books that you handed me and doing what I was told to do, I've been sober 21 years and about 9 months. And this year I'll have 22 years in this fellowship. And as far as I'm concerned, that means I'm just over 21. I'm now old enough to drink, you know. I reckon that makes sense. Y'all have to tell me if anything I say makes sense. But you know, when I was a little boy, I was always looking for my daddy, and he was never there. My daddy was an alcoholic. And he was a commercial fisherman, and he went out on the Atlantic Ocean. I used to call it his drying out spot on the sea. And he'd go out there and he'd stay for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And I used to lay around my bed at night dreaming about him coming home. just saying, boy, when my daddy comes home, I'm going to go to the ball game with him. I'm going to do this with him. I'm going to do that with him. And to me, my daddy was a hero because he went out on the ocean and he went out there in the wintertime. And sometimes those old bean trawlers would ice up, you know, and they'd have to beat ice and cold weather and stormy weather. And he was a big hero to me. And my daddy would come home and he'd be carrying two great big buckets of fish in boxes. And I'd see him coming up the street and my heart would flutter. I'd be so happy. Here comes my daddy. And he'd come home and he wouldn't say nothing to me. And he'd throw the fish down and he'd go in and he'd get a big old bath and shave, you know, 2 or 3 weeks beard growth, you know. I'd be waiting for my daddy. Where I'd know it, he'd show up, be all dressed in a suit and he'd be out the door. And however many days he'd be home, he'd be gone, drinking and gambling. And I always felt disappointed, and I always felt lost, and I always felt abandoned, and I always felt a sense of shame. I always felt, I understand today, that there was something wrong with me because my daddy didn't recognize me. My daddy never recognized my existence because my daddy was too sick to do that because he had this disease. And he was a real sick person, and he still is. He's still alive and he's still sick because he's never had any treatment. He's never been in AA. He's never had anything to make it any different for him. But I grew up feeling that sense of inadequacy and that sense of shame and feeling like I was an outsider, you know. I was on the outside looking in, you know. When I got into grammar school, I was a good student. I was a natural student, and I got all A's, and I got some recognition for that from my teachers. But the kids that I was in school with used to make fun of me. They used to call me teacher's pet and put me down because I was such a good student. So again, I felt a sense of shame and inadequacy, and like I was on the outside of my crew, you know? I said, gee, when am I ever going to fit in here anyway? And that's kind of the way I went along through grammar school, and I guess for some reason I really don't understand, I still continue to do well in grammar school. The first 8 years, I could identify a lot with a speaker last night. I went to an Irish Catholic grammar school, and I had nuns, and I'm Irish descent, 100% Irish descent, you know. And all I knew is I did well in school. I felt like an outsider. I wasn't happy. And everywhere I looked, my father and all my uncles were drinking and raising hell, and I just thought that was the way to be, you know. And when I was 14, I want to tell this much of my drunken log. When I was 14, I was in a park, and some of the kids I was with, they dared me to break into a house and steal some booze. So to get my first drink of booze, I committed a burglary, and I broke into a house, and I stole a fifth of Seagram 7. And I took it out on this park, and I drank it like it was the last fifth of booze in the world. I drank 80 to 90% of that booze, and I traded it, you know, off to my friend that I was drinking with. And every time he'd get it, I'd look at him, and I'd say, that son of a gun, better give that back quick, you know? I mean, I like that stuff. I don't know who else was like me here, but I like the sight of it, the taste of it, the smell of it, the way it made me feel, man. I love booze. I still love booze. How do you like that? I like booze. I just don't like what it does to me when I drink it. I love booze. I like it. I like to drink this stuff. That's why I'm here. But you know, that first drunk, I became one of the boys, you know. I was accepted in my peer group. And I loved booze. And I got rip-roaring drunk. I ran around the city crazily. I turned in a false fire alarm. I got sick as a junkyard dog. I vomited all over the place. I passed out. My mother had to come down and carry me up over this hill and throw me in the bed, you know. I was delirious out of my mind. I was convinced that I had killed this guy that I was drinking with. I woke up the next morning, the bed was spinning. I was filled with fear, anxiety, guilt, remorse, shame. I wanted to kill myself. I felt like the lowest thing on earth. I was 14 years old. That was my first drunk. Now, if I had known anything, I would have known from that experience that I had to be an alcoholic. Because from that experience with alcohol, I fell in love with the stuff. I fell in love with the stuff. And I never once, after that day, I never once refused an opportunity to drink booze. And I want to tell you, I did a lot of other drugs besides alcohol. As far as I know, alcohol is a drug. And being alcohol addicted makes me a drug addict. But I did a lot of drugs, a lot of alcohol, and a lot of drugs for 11 years from the time I was 14 until I was 25 years old. I never once refused an opportunity to drink booze. And I live my life exactly the way as was described in those steps that Bill Sanders read last night, that Bill Hollingsworth left to us. Boy, could I identify with all that. That's the way I live my life. I had an attitude when I drank. Let me tell you just a little bit about it. When I drank, I now felt like I was not on the outside of anything. I felt like I was in communion with the whole universe. You know, everybody loved me, and I loved everybody else. And there was no conflict, and there was no trouble. And I felt all-powerful when I drank. I felt omnipotent when I drank. I felt like I was indestructible when I drank. I felt like Superman when I drank. And I thought I was going to drink for 75 or 80 years. And I was going to drink all the booze I could get my hands on. I was going to have one hell of a time drinking. And I was going to have sex with 3,000 or 4,000 women at least. This is not bad, you know? Why worry about what Daddy thinks of me now? Or anything on a feelings level, you know. Just get out there and, like that Nike ad says, just do it, you know. And I also want to tell you that I developed an incredible quality of arrogance. Does anybody identify with being arrogant? I thought I knew more than my teachers. I thought I knew more than just about anybody, you know? And I could look at any person or any situation that was going on, and I could analyze it and tell you why it was happening the way it was happening. And I could certainly look at any guy I was drinking with or doing drugs with or any gal and look at them and see how screwed up they were and see what they needed to do, and I could tell them. And oftentimes in my drinking life, I told people what they needed to do to be successful in life. And I didn't wait for them to ask me either. So I got a lot of people angry. That still hasn't changed in a lot of ways. But the arrogance was... I like to think of my arrogance as being impenetrable. Impenetrable arrogance. I mean, it was the kind of arrogance that just withstood all sorts of confrontation, you know? I didn't shake it loose very easily. I was kind of stuck on it. It was a major defense that I had during the years that I drank. I heard it from the first speaker, from Charlie, you know? I felt so terrible about myself. I felt so much shame because my daddy didn't love me. I felt so much guilt about the things I did when I drank, you know? That I just had to cover it up with an attitude of, I know what I'm doing all the time. I always can figure out the right answer, and I always have to be right, you know? And that was one of the major ways that I dealt with reality. The other thing that I did was, that was came out into my attitude was I didn't develop any sense of identity. So that certainly, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no identity at all. The kind of identity I had, I like to call it borderline, was whatever you wanted me to be, I would be. Have you ever heard that anywhere before? Whatever you wanted me to be, I would be. And I could be in a group drinking and drugging, and I could listen to what was being said, or I could listen to what was being asked, and I would tell you whatever you wanted to hear. I would tell you whatever you wanted to hear. You know, keep the booze and the drugs flowing. Let's not have a conflict. Let's not have a fight. I hated to fight when I was drinking, although I got in some. I hated to fight when I was drinking because it got in the way of my drinking and interfered with what I wanted to do, which was stay stoned, you know? So I just went through my life like that, you know? And I was always, like you've heard before, trying to find something out there that would make me feel better about myself. Something that would remove the shame and the guilt and feeling inadequate. Something that would take that away. And let me just tell you one critical part of my drunkalogue to show you what it's like to be a sick alcoholic and not have any identity. All of my life growing up, you know, from 1943 on, I never once said to myself, I think when I grow up, I want to be a defender of my country. I want to be a patriot. I want to protect y'all from the enemy. I never thought that in my life. I had no interest in protecting anybody from y'all's enemies. But when I was 19 years old, I was drunk, I was sick, I was drinking my way out of college, I was quitting college before I would flunk out. And I went to see this friend of mine who was a lot older than I was, who used to help me get booze, and he was at least as sick as I was. And he looked at me, and I told him I was, you know, I was leaving school. And, you know, I was leaving school because I was angry. I developed another thing called a global resentment. I had global resentments. I was angry at every person, place, thing, institution, religion, organization, whatever you want to name. I was angry at it and all about why, and I could tell you why. And I was leaving academia. Bunch of phonies, I said. Bunch of fakers. You know, it was 1962. And I went to see my friend. He was a sick cookie. He looked at me and he said, you know, there's only one thing wrong with you, he said. And I said to myself, the son of a gun. What one thing could that be, you know, in the back of my mind? What one thing could it possibly be that was wrong with me? I learned that from my mother. He said, you're good-looking. He said, you're a well-spoken, articulate, intelligent young man. He said, and I loved every word of it, he said, the only thing you're missing is self-discipline. He said, if you had some self-discipline, you'd be successful in life. He said, why don't you join the United States Marine Corps? Now, this is where I'm talking about a lack of identity, which I think is the crux of our illness. The next day, drunk, I joined the goddamn Marine Corps. Woo! Sick. Good timing. You know, let me tell you a story about that. I know a lot of folks who think they're sophisticated in 1990, you know, with all these treatment centers and all this stuff going on, these new methods of detoxification and all of this. In 1962, I rode on a train drunk to Paris Island. And because I was the tallest in the group and coming out of Boston, they gave me the records for the whole crew. And when we got to Paris Island, a little place called Yamasee, I wrote a story years later called Surprise at Yamasee. Drunk, dead drunk, I led the gang off the train to meet the DI. Caught my foot on the bottom step and went flying right out in his face, flat on my face, with the records going all over the place and that DI flying all over my ass. And I was detoxed in 6 1/2 seconds. No! No medical doctors, no Transine necessary, thank you. And I had my first smack at sobriety in Paris Island. For 13 weeks, I didn't take a drink or a drug, and I didn't even smoke a cigarette, and I was also a nicotine addict for a long time. And those DIs scared the heck out of me. And I became an excellent Marine. Let me tell you why. I'm a typical alcoholic. I'm counterphobic. I was so scared that those guys, those DIs, would find out how scared I was. Right? That I did anything and everything they told me to do, and I did it real well. Fear is a great motivator. You know? And I had some experiences in the Marine Corps, I want to tell you. Man, if I had to do them again, I think I'd move to China. You know? But I just did them. I just did them. And I had a lot of ups and downs, and it was rough. And to make a long story short, I always tried to keep up the front, you know? And I always overachieved while I was getting sicker. I would overachieve, and in the Marine Corps I got meritorious promotions and all kinds of things. And I also got busted in the Marine Corps and disgraced and humiliated because I went where I wasn't supposed to go because I was looking for a drink. Or whatever. But the whole thing was, I didn't know who I was. I had no sense of identity. I just wasn't there. All that was there was this front of a person who was pretending and trying to do the right thing without knowing how to do it. You know? Because there was nothing internal that was mine. It was just all a lot of programming from a sick family, from a sick environment, and a lot of programming from my own disease, my active disease of chemical dependency, addiction. And I was one sick and suffering human being. And I was in tremendous agony and pain. And my insides, I thought I was going insane. And I went through hell. I went through hell, man. I remember how it felt. I'm the kind of guy, I remember when today. That's why I'm so happy I'm with my fellow alcoholics in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because this is where I belong. This is God's gift to me that He gave to me through the first 100. This is my seat back there in this meeting, and I'm not going to give it up just because I get a resentment, which I often get them. But I was sick and suffering and dying. I was hopeless and helpless when I came here. And when I came here, I want to share a few minutes what it was like, just for 5 minutes. I resisted this program. I had a tremendous false ego. And I relate with the sick newcomers a lot to this day, and I feel for them because I was the same way. I resisted the program. I resisted the 12 steps, and I became a two-stepper. I lived on the first step and the 12th step for the first 8 years of my sobriety. That's how I did it. I got to a point after 22 months where I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable, and I had 22 months of sobriety, and I completely surrendered to the fact that I was sick and I was always going to be sick, and it broke my heart, and I cried like a baby the day it happened. Because the old Tom Hickey died that day. The guy that was going to have, I was going to design my own life. The old Tom Hickey, I was going to design my own life. No steps was going to design me. And that person died, essentially died, when I took the first step. But it took me 22 months to integrate the first step into my soul. And then I jumped to the... I did try to practice some of the other steps, but I didn't integrate any of those steps. I went on to the 12th step, carrying the message. And that's the way I went for 8 years. And at 8 years... I had a personal, sober low where I completely knew that I could not run my own life. I was divorced. I was living in an apartment by myself. I had been living there for quite a few years. My work life was successful, but my personal life was a disaster. Okay. And with that happening to me at that time, all I was able to do was surrender, realizing that my way wasn't going to work whether I was drinking or whether I was sober. I surrendered to the 12 steps of this program. And from that time until today, from 8 years of sobriety to what I have today, 21 and a half years that I've been with y'all, every morning I get up and I turn my life and my will over to my God and to the idea that for me, I must live to the best of my ability in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And from trying to do that, I now know who I am. And I like who I am. And I know how to parent myself. And my parent is God. And that is He is my ultimate parent. And He parents me and carries me through every day of my life. In all of my things that I'm doing, I have a great wife. I have a marriage that I love. I have four fabulous children. I have great work. I have great friends. I'm successful in every area. I want to tell you that. I'm successful in every area of my life because I enjoy everything in my life, my work life, my marriage, my children, my AA life, my financial life, my sexual life. I enjoy every part of my life. And I'm grateful for everything I have. And everything I have, I owe to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as I attempt to live in those steps. The thing I want to leave you with, though, is the greatest gift that I have with all the years I've been in the program is knowing that I'm just getting started. And all the years that I have to look forward to of more personal growth and more spiritual growth, the answer lies in still more spiritual growth. and I still have plenty of problems. I'm a human being. But the answer lies in still more spiritual growth through the 12 steps, through living in the 12 steps. And I'm just happy that today is the first day of the rest of my life, and I can look forward to the next 40 or 50 years with y'all living and growing in the great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. I lived on the first step and the 12th step for the first 8 years of my sobriety. That's how I did it. I got to a point after 22 months where I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable, and I had 22 months of sobriety, and I completely surrendered to the fact that I was sick and I was always going to be sick, and it broke my heart, and I cried like a baby the day it happened. Because the old Tom Hickey died that day. The guy that was going to have, I was going to design my own life. The old Tom Hickey, I was going to design my own life. No steps was going to design me. And that person died, essentially died, when I took the first step. But it took me 22 months to integrate the first step into my soul. And then I jumped to the, I did try to practice some of the other steps, but I didn't integrate any of those steps. I went on to the 12th step, carrying the message. And that's the way I went for 8 years. And at 8 years, I had a personal, sober low where I completely knew that I could not run my own life. I was divorced. I was living in an apartment by myself. I had been living there for quite a few years. My work life was successful, but my personal life was a disaster. Okay. And with that happening to me at that time, all I was able to do was surrender, realizing that my way wasn't going to work whether I was drinking or whether I was sober. I surrendered to the 12 steps of this program. And from that time until today, from 8 years of sobriety to what I have today, 21 and a half years that I've been with y'all, every morning I get up and I turn my life and my will over to my God and to the idea that for me, I must live to the best of my ability in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And from trying to do that, I now know who I am, and I like who I am. And I know how to parent myself. And my parent is God. And that is He is my ultimate parent. And He parents me and carries me through every day of my life and all of my things that I'm doing. I have a great wife. I have a marriage that I love. I have four fabulous children. I have great work. I have great friends. I'm successful in every area. I want to tell you that. I'm successful in every area of my life because I enjoy everything in my life. My work life, my marriage, my children, my AA life, my financial life, my sexual life. I enjoy every part of my life. And I'm grateful for everything I have. And everything I have, I owe to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as I attempt to live in those steps. The thing I want to leave you with, though, is the greatest gift that I have with all the years I've been in the program is knowing that I'm just getting started. And all the years that I have to look forward to of more personal growth and more spiritual growth, the answer lies in still more spiritual growth. And I still have plenty of problems. I'm a human being. But the answer lies in still more spiritual growth through the 12 steps, through living in the 12 steps. And I'm just happy that today is the first day of the rest of my life, and I can look forward to the next 40 or 50 years with y'all living and growing in the great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. I'm still glad you got sober. I look around at all these meetings, and I see some of these great big old men in here, and I'm sure glad I didn't know them when they was drinking. So I weighed about 130 pounds then, and I got false teeth anyhow. I'd have just got them earlier, I reckon. I don't know. Appreciate it a lot, Tom. Our next speaker is also kind of from a mountain fella, halfway, I guess you might say mountain, up in Dunwoody, Georgia. What's wrong with Dunwoody? Jay Honeycutt, I love you. Come on up and tell us about it.
Hey, it's good to be back here again. I have an idea there's one or two of you that remember that I was up here for the Friday night session back in March, I guess it was. I keep wanting to say last year, you know, these things run yearly a lot of places, so if I say that, just bear with me. What I have to think about is that, and you know, it reminds me of a story. You ever hear about the guy that had this rare disease? And it kept recurring, and every time he'd get it, he'd go to a doctor, and they'd check him over again, and they'd go over and over, and they never could do anything about it, and he'd come back again. He finally changed doctors again and went in to see this doctor. And the doctor examined him very thoroughly, and he got out the medical books, and he read, and he thought, and he scratched his head. He said, "You ever had this before?" The guy said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you got it again." And that's sort of the way I feel about being here. I got it again. And, you know, I still got it. And until I get a whole lot better, I guess I'm going to have to keep coming back here and try to get it straightened out. Jimmy made this big thing up here about Dunwoody. If you look in the last program, it said I live in Atlanta. And I was sort of proud of that. And now it says Dunwoody, and I don't know where that came from. I live in Dunwoody. I haven't moved. I don't want you to think that I moved to a more affluent location, because I didn't. I am a living example. You can spend a few years in this program and not become financially successful. And well, you look at other people around here with name tags on it and say, Dunwoody. Look at Wes, how affluent looking he looks. But I have found out, you know, I've been there 22 years, and I live in the old section of Dunwoody, the very moderate section of Dunwoody. And I just find out I'm not maybe quite as much in debt as those on the north side of town. And that's the big difference, I guess. I got to tell an Al-Nine story. But you know, what they do, the Dunwoody thing, if you live in Atlanta, you know that's the thing they joke about all the time. And what's the joke? How do you tell the Dunwoody housewife at a funeral? She's the one in the black tennis outfit. Yeah. We have an Al-Anon speaking tonight, and out of deference for that, I think I just got to tell an Al-Anon story. I don't usually do this, because there are usually Al-Anons in the room, and usually my wife's there, and it gets me in trouble. But she cleared this one before I left the house. And you'll see you'll see in a minute why. There was this lady that joined Al-Anon, and she was living with a practicing alcoholic. And they told her, Al-Anon, you really need to straighten your life out and get to looking better and feeling better. So she said, I need a checkup, and I'm going to the doctor. I haven't had one in years. She came back from the doctor, and there's her husband on the couch with a beer watching a football game. And she walked in, got between him and the couch, and she was very amply endowed. And she says, I just had an examination. He says, big deal. And she says, well, I want you to know that the doctor said I had the breast of a 20-year-old. He says, well, so what? He says, what did he say about your 50-year-old ass? She says, frankly, he didn't mention you. You know, my prologue runs 30 minutes, so we're not going to get into anything else. But I'll get on with this in a minute. As I told you when I was here before, I always wanted to be an evangelist, and I'm prone to preach, and so I apologize up front for that. But I got to tell one evangelist story, and this is not as good as the ones you heard last time, and I won't tell those over again. But This is the one about the three ministers that were to retreat like this and go out on Saturday afternoon, and they're walking in the country and they walk by a pasture and there's some sheep over in the pasture and they've been there a week without any women. It's all like this place. And the Baptist minister said, "Boy, look at that sheep over there." Says, "I wish that was Kim Basinger." And the Methodist minister says, "Yeah, man, I know what you're talking about." He said, "I wish that was Cheryl Teagues." The other guy happened to be a TV evangelist, and he looked over there and said, "I tell you what I wish it was dark." I wish I hadn't told that. Shows you where I came from. Hey, we'd better get on with this. I'm Jerry Honeycutt, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and because of people like you in rooms like these, and because I finally found it necessary in my life to take the 12 steps, I have not found it necessary to take a drink since June the 4th of 1984, and for that I'm grateful. But let me tell you about that word necessary. I always use it and I always make a point of it, because it's like my good friend Jim Hawkins over in Alabama said about the guy in his group that was sharing one night, and he stood up and said, "I haven't found it necessary to take a drink in 2 years. Somebody in the back of the room said, "You know you're lying. You were drunk last week." He said, "Yeah, I know that, but it wasn't necessary." And the point of that is, I think we can flounder around in this program, and I did it for a number of years, and you can reach the point that you may have to take a drink, but it's not necessary, because there are ways to get around it. And one of those ways, and I brought the book up here to remind me, is right here on page 58 and 59, how it works, and it has the steps there that are suggested as a program of recovery. Let me tell you a minute about my drinking career. I started drinking when I was 18 years old, and my drinking was characterized very early by being able to control it somewhat. Because if I look back on that, I can tell that there were times in my life when I drank too much, but it was usually by intent. And if I didn't need to get drunk, fine. I was an abuser, but not necessarily an alcoholic as such. I had all the isms. I like the definition that's in chapter 3 of the big book that says, "We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking." Pure and simply. So for years, I went along that way. I don't know how long. At some point, I got to where I couldn't control it as well anymore. And the big problem was it got so progressive, but very slowly, and I didn't recognize it. One day at a time, I had to drink a little earlier than I did the day before, and I had to drink a little more than I did the day before. And I'm sure we have all reached that point, because I got to the point, finally, that I heard described very eloquently one time as the very fine line between the shakes of not enough to drink and the dismal abyss of too much to drink is always so fine that I can't find it. And I reached a point for about 10 years that I couldn't find that euphoria anymore. It wasn't there. And one minute I'm shaking, and the next minute I'm drunk. And I would always just show up somewhere drunk when just a few minutes before I had been somewhat in control of myself, except I had the shakes. So for a number of years, I went on like that for about 10 years, and it about destroyed me. You know, I am convinced that our external circumstances are, what make us different. I am convinced that if we talk about religion, race, creed, color, finances, education, whatever, we're all different, and we can find a lot of differences. Down deep inside, you and I are the same, because if I talk about my feelings and my fears, I'm talking about you, because deep down inside, we are all basically the same when we are alcoholic. And that is that we're afraid, for one thing. I don't know about you, but I was afraid all my life. I wouldn't admit it, and I went around trying to be macho and big and a man, but I was afraid. I was scared to death. And I was always afraid of how other people perceived me, what other people thought, afraid of everybody and everything. And I went that way for many years. Not only was I afraid, I was dissatisfied. I was never satisfied with who I was with, where I was, what I was doing. Never satisfied. Nothing was ever big enough, good enough, fast enough, red enough. Nothing was ever enough. Not only did I have these problems, I was hypersensitive. I don't know about you, but I went around all the time, and if anybody made the slightest criticism of me, I really got my feelings hurt, just to the point of it being a major problem in my life. Along with all this, I was a hopeless romantic. And not being a ladies' man, this was frustrating for a good part of my younger life, when I loved all the ladies and they wouldn't have anything to do with me. And then, on top of all that, an idealist, a perfectionist, paranoid, anxiety-ridden, I found out one day that I didn't like reality. And I became a dreamer. And I sat around and dreamed about things that were different. And I sat around and dreamed about one day somebody or something would come along and change reality for me. And one day it did, and it's called alcohol. And it took away the fear, and it took away all that pain. And it allowed me to function in a world I hadn't been able to function in before. And if you were paranoid and afraid and a misfit in society, and you found something that took away the pain, filled that void, something that put meaning where there'd been no meaning before, it would be important to you, and it was important to me. And for many years, alcohol was the answer to my problems and not my problem. And of course, one day, like all of us, if we are alcoholic, it turns into our enemy, and it turned into my enemy. And it took me a long time to know that. But today, I'm convinced that I'm going to be addicted to something, and I might as well be addicted to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because feeling good is not a luxury to me, it's an absolute necessity. I have to feel good. And I do that through the steps and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You think about it the next time you ask an alcoholic not to take a drink. Because if that person isn't drinking, they're not taking the thing that has been life to them for so many years. Now, it's probably turned on them at that point. But they don't always realize that. And that's why the denial, I think, is there so much. They still remember those days when alcohol kept them alive, when they had nothing else. But it turns into the enemy, and when it does, and we have to get rid of it, and I had to get rid of it, I had to find something else to fill that void, something to take away the pain, something to do for me what alcohol had done at one time. You know, I talked about external circumstances. I was born in a cotton mill village as an only child in North Carolina in 1932, and from there it went downhill. If you can believe that. And I'm not going to get into a drunkalogue. I love them, and I love to get into them. And go back and listen to the tape. I put a bunch of them in there last time. But anyhow, I went around for many years, went through school, did all the things, struggled with all that, drinking all the way, but not a whole lot. And then I joined a very large computer company and fell in with a crowd that drank. And I always liked to be like everybody else and do what everybody else was doing. Moved to Atlanta in 1968 and took a traveling job and started traveling with people who drank. Started figuring out, it dawned on me one day that there was nothing magic about 5 o'clock. There were some people that had been smart enough to figure out that you could drink at noontime. And so I started drinking at noon like a lot of other people did. And then one day I realized I couldn't do without that noon drink because I couldn't get through the afternoon without it. And then it started getting earlier in the morning. And you know the story. And before I knew it, I was drinking round the clock. And in 1984, I got on my knees one day, and I was dying. I had just been to my doctor, and I was sick, and I was not going to make it too much further. And he says, do you know what alcohol is going to do to you? And I said, sure, I think I know. And he said, well, just in case you don't, it's going to kill you. And I said, well, I'm just not ready to, at this point, stop drinking. And he said, when you are, let me know, and I'll put you in treatment. And I went home and I got down on my knees and of course I was just afraid to go in treatment. I was afraid what my company might do and all those kind of things like we all are. And I got on my knees and I said, God help me. I just need help. I don't know where to go. I'm dying inside. I had to shake so bad I couldn't drive to work in the morning. I just can't go on anymore like this. I was completely alienated to my family. My wife had completely, you know, gone away and left me alone. She had been an Al-Anon at this point about a year. And she had detached from me with love, babes. And life was over and done with for me, purely and simple, unless I found some way out. And I asked God for help, and God saw fit to let me crash and burn at a big affair on a weekend, my last big drunk. And that happened to be a christening party for my first grandchild that my wife and I and my son's in-laws were giving. And it was at a noon on Sunday, and not only was I the only drunk there, I was the only, you know, nobody else had even had a drink. And, you know, as you know and I know, you can go to parties where other people are drinking and get drunk, and you're not so noticeable. Believe me, I was noticeable. If you want high visibility, you be the only person that falls out drunk at a party and propositions all the young women and finally passes out in the den, right in the middle of it. And this is a christening affair for a grandchild of mine. That about destroyed me, because when I came to on that Sunday afternoon and looked around at my family, you can't imagine the hurt and humiliation that I saw in their eyes. Now, I had wrecked the cars. I had lost rental cars, some they've never found. And all this kind of thing for years, and that didn't bother me all that much. That was just, you know, that was the tricks of the trade, and that went with the territory. You know, everybody did those kind of things. But I couldn't handle it when I finally saw my family in just complete and total disgust that they put up with me for so long, and I'm getting worse. And I knew that I had no control over what I did on that Sunday afternoon. So what I did the next morning, I turned myself in to the big boss and said, I got a problem and I need some help. And at the same time, unbeknownst to me, my wife had gone to her minister and was seeking a divorce because she asked him what to do about seeing a lawyer. So it had come to an end at that point. And that was God working in my life. And so I went to a treatment center and I did all those things, and that didn't work out too well either, but I don't have time for that. That's another story. And I was there 6 weeks, and they finally turned me loose on the world, and I started going to AA. And for 8 months I went to AA and I didn't do anything else right. I didn't drink and I went to meetings, and that's all I did for 8 months. And at the end of 8 months I was dying. I felt physically somewhat better, as you know, but nothing else was working out. And my relationship with my family was getting worse instead of better, and I didn't understand this. I thought this program was supposed to help, and it was not helping me at all. And I just couldn't figure it out. So I said, I'm going to do the right thing. I got two sponsors. If one's good, two's better. And the problem with that, each of them was afraid to talk to me, so they depended on the other one, I think. And neither one of them really told me very much. And I got a home group, and my sponsor said, read the big book. They were afraid to tell me to work the steps. Both of them knew that I was having nothing to do with the steps at that point in time, but they were afraid to tell me about it. And they didn't want to come to me because they said they had taken a pool on when I was going to get drunk. And those who were trying to win the pool didn't want to try to help me. And I'm joking, of course. There were a lot of people there with a lot of good meaning, but they didn't know how to approach me, and they weren't sure what was best to do for me. So they said, read the big book. That went right over my head. I read the big book. I read how it works. I read it over and over again. And, you know, if there was ever anything, that was written down in 1939 in the first printing of the big book. So it has passed the test of time. I should have understood that. It is also written by an alcoholic to other alcoholics who it says right here on page 59, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. You know, any idiot could figure that out. I obviously hadn't gotten back up to that mentality level yet. Because I didn't figure that out. That didn't make any sense to me. So what happened was, and of course, you know, if you go in a meeting room, have you ever noticed that the steps are on the wall, and there they are, and they very patiently wait for people like you and I, and they'll always be there. They just sit there. They don't bother anybody, but they're always there, and every time you walk in, you see them. But today, you know, I read them more than I used to, and I listen to how it works a little more than I used to. But what happened is that I made a conscious decision about this time in my dryness, and I started to say sobriety, but I wasn't sober at all at this point. In my dryness, I made a very conscious decision, and that was that I wasn't going to work the steps. That was for the real sick drunks, and I wasn't one of them. I just didn't fit into that category at all, so I decided I'm not going to do that. I don't see the effort. That's my alcoholic brain had finally talked me in to dying. But I didn't figure that out. Now, let me tell you, there is a big difference between just procrastinating and not working the steps for some period of time and making a decision not to work them. Because what happened to me is, all of a sudden, I found out I fell back into those old ways again. I am now unique. I am now different. I am now dishonest. I now have a secret. Because you're not going to go to a meeting and get up and share with people that you don't think you have to practice the steps. I've never heard anybody do that. Can you imagine what would happen? They'd lynch you right there. I mean, or you would think you were before you got out of there. I mean, you know, there's people that would ricochet off the walls if you made a statement such as that. And so I was smart enough not to say that, but I was dumb enough to make a decision that I wasn't going to work the steps. I actually decided I'm not going to do that. Now, of course, unbeknownst to me all along, I had really, at some point in time, worked the first three. I think if you hang around the program for about 3 years, as I had at this point, you're going to do that whether you want to or not. Because it's like Jimmy Harris says, that going to AA meetings is like running through a cotton field in a blue serge suit. You're going to get it on you whether you want to or not. And you're going to hear a lot of things whether you want to or not. And so a lot of that had worked in. And then I finally reached that point that I realized that I was unhappy, I was resentful, and I had all the problems you can have that I won't go through. My relationship with my family was no better. My wife and I weren't getting along all that well, and that was going to come to an end because she was making progress in her program and I was not making any progress in mine. And things were getting real tough. And I finally went to a good friend of mine and I says, what is it that's going wrong here? I try everything. You know, I get on my knees and I turn it over and I do all these wonderful things. And why is it, will you tell me, that things are not getting better in my life? He said, I'm going to tell you. The reason is that you haven't consciously decided to work the steps, and that is obvious. And you've been in the program long enough that you're going to die in the program. Because you can live on the fellowship for a short term, and that short term is different for all of us, and you've reached the end of yours. And you can live on the fellowship, you can survive on the fellowship, but for long-term contentment, long-term peace of mind, you must work the steps. So I said, well, if you're going to be that way about it, I'll give it a shot. You know, what have I got to lose? So I went back, and I worked my way back through 1, 2, and 3, knowing that when I got to 4, I was going to quit.
The original master recording cut off at this point.